Welcome to the America's Quarterly Podcast. I'm Brian Winter. Colombia has been back in international headlines following a recent spate of violence in the countryside. How worried should we be?
In a lot of ways, what we're seeing is kind of a tale of two countries, the urban Colombia and the rural Colombia. A lot of the massacres and the social leaders getting gunned down. A lot of this is happening out in pretty deep rural areas. And so a lot of new gangs and drug trafficking groups have moved into this power vacuum.
When you speak to Colombians in early 2021, whether they're from the business world or civil society or elsewhere, you kind of get the same vibe, a sense of unease, almost dread, and in some cases, fear about the year ahead, like the country is almost adrift in some ways. And from the outside in, it can be tough to figure out why, because it's been a tough year for everybody. And Colombia is pretty average in terms of what's happening with the economic damage from COVID, the toll that it's taken on human lives. The president, Iván Duque, his popularity is low, but not terribly so in the mid-30s or so. And even on the security front, which is always of concern in Colombia, the news is not all bad. Violence has been coming down for years, and last year, the country's homicide rate fell to a 46-year low, aided in part by people being at home because of the pandemic. But look, the other side of this is that power vacuums left by the FARC in rural areas have been filled by armed groups fighting to control coca crops and illegal mining territory. And as a result, violence against social leaders and human rights activists has really been a problem. At least 310 such leaders were killed in 2020, according to the Institute for Development and Peace Studies, and 18 social leaders have already been killed or have disappeared this year. Meanwhile, there have been signs of strength overall from organized crime groups. That was the subject of the new issue of America's Quarterly. It all makes for an uncertain environment, with presidential elections also coming up in mid-2022. To understand the mood in Colombia and the risks the country faces in coming months, I'm joined today by my friend John Otis. John is a longtime Colombia-based journalist, author of the book Law of the Jungle, and recent author of an article about some of these topics for America's Quarterly. John, thank you for being on the AQ podcast.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
So, John, let's dive right in with what's happening in the security situation. I mean, what's your sense, what's your reaction to kind of the way that I just spoke about things with specific regard to the killing of social leaders? I was also hoping that for our audience, you could just briefly talk about what that means in Colombia, because it's a protected, I suppose, category in some ways that really is a barometer for the overall security situation. What's happening with them, and how does that impact the feeling in the country as a whole?
Well, first of all, Brian, we have to always keep in mind that Colombia really has changed a lot. I got here 24 years ago, and that was probably about the worst period ever for security here. Lots and lots of kidnappings, lots of massacres. The war was sort of reaching its peak. You know, that situation has really changed a lot for the better. The peace accord that the government signed here in 2016, it has made a difference. Homicide rate is down. It is a new country. It is a safer country. But that said, the peace accord hasn't worked out perfectly. And in a lot of ways, what we're seeing is kind of a tale of two countries, the urban Colombia and the rural Colombia. A lot of the massacres you're talking about and the social leaders getting gunned down and environmental leaders and also former FARC guerrillas. A lot of this is happening out in pretty deep rural areas. It is a serious problem. You know, it's something that I think the government here hasn't paid enough attention to. They're trying to present themselves as really strong on national security, but they haven't really gotten a good handle on security in the countryside. And so a lot of new gangs and drug trafficking groups have moved into this power vacuum. And that's a lot of what we're seeing right now, these groups fighting with one another and going after any sort of independent voices out there, people who are willing to push back.
John, just before we leave behind the subject of the social leaders, can you just define for us kind of what this group is? I know that according to one classification, there are nearly 5,000 of these people throughout Colombia, and they tend to benefit from these government protection schemes, everything from bulletproof jackets to armored cars and bodyguards. The Duque government says that they're doing a lot to protect these folks. Is there more they could do? What do you think the core issue here is?
Remember, these are people, they're independent voices in a lot of areas that were controlled by the FARC. So when the FARC guerrillas disarmed under the 2016 peace accord, it opened up a lot of space, at least initially, for environmentalists, for land rights activists to really take a bigger voice in things. And when you start pushing for land rights in areas where the narcos are coming in and wanting to plant more coca, which is the raw material for cocaine, you know, these groups are going to take out their weapons and go after these people. And, you know, you mentioned protection, Brian. The government does have a protection service where they do hand out bulletproof vests and bodyguards and so forth, but there's really not enough to go around. And so, you know, only a small percentage of these thousands of at-risk leaders are getting that kind of protection. And even when you do get that kind of protection, it doesn't always work. I mean, for example, Carmen Garcia, one of the women I interviewed for the story that just ran in America's Quarterly about these groups recruiting youths, you know, recruiting kids who are not in school into their ranks. You know, she did have a bodyguard and a government-provided car, but they were driving along a road in northern Colombia, and they just got stopped by some guerrillas from the ELN, which is the smaller guerrilla group here. And they pulled them over, and the guerrillas held them for 5 or 6 hours and threatened this woman and let her off with a warning and let them go. So just goes to show that even having government protection doesn't always work.
Do you agree, John, that there's this kind of unsettled mood among people right now? Because, look, the Colombia progress story that you point to is one that I know well. You know, I helped write a book about many years ago, but it is, you know, 10 years old at this point. And what I sense now, and I think this is partly because of the protests that we saw in 2019, is that the narrative has shifted so much. You have a generation also that is, you know, in a young country, and this happens, time passes quickly. People don't really remember what the bad old days were like, but there's something else, right? I mean, at least I detect in my conversations with folks, which is just a sense of things being adrift. I mean, do you think that's just driven by kind of sensationalist headlines, or maybe even a country that now with the peace process, you know, underway with all its imperfections, doesn't really know what the national narrative is? I mean, what do you think is really going on?
I think it's a lot of that. It's a combination of that. I think it's also higher expectations. When you've ended a big, long guerrilla war, and when the country is sort of moving into a middle-income status, when Colombia is seen as kind of a success story, your expectations are raised. Education levels are going up. People want more. A lot of the protests here that broke out in late 2019 had to do with rising expectations. People want better. They want, you know, better education. They want to be able to go to the university. They want decent jobs and that sort of thing. The combination right now, anyway, of the pandemic, the economy, kind of the wheels coming off, this rising sense of insecurity out in the countryside. President Duque is overall seen as kind of a weak leader who doesn't really have a handle on everything here. I think a lot of those things are combined to give people this sort of sense that Colombia might be a little bit rudderless right now.
John, also on the security front, the new Biden administration raised some eyebrows on Twitter and elsewhere. It seems like they're really going to put full implementation of the peace process front and center in their diplomacy with the Duque administration. Can you just tell us briefly kind of where all that stands and how contentious that could get?
Right now, it's, you know, the Duque administration has been deeply criticized for not following through with the peace process. And as you know, Brian, in any kind of peace treaty, negotiating the thing may be hard, but putting peace treaties actually into place on the ground is a heck of a lot harder. In the case of the Colombian peace treaty, it's a very complex document and it's hundreds of pages long. And, you know, what tends to happen is as soon as you managed to disarm the guerrillas or whoever you signed the peace treaty with. You forget about all the other stuff, which in the Colombia case includes a lot about land reform and rural development and kind of getting rid of the underlying economic factors that caused the guerrillas to rise up in the first place. And Colombia did a very good job at disarming the FARC. And then after that, a lot of people really lost interest. Even the Santos government, you know, they signed this peace treaty, they negotiated, sort of lost interest too, and didn't do much in terms of rural development. And so that's been a big problem with the Duque administration. And the Duque administration has also been very critical of this transitional justice court known here as the HEP, which was set up to carry out investigations of war crimes and just the behavior of the armed factors in the war, both the military and the guerrillas and paramilitaries. And so the Duque administration went after the HEP and tried to kind of take away some of its powers and weaken it. You know, that didn't work out. And, you know, the government seemed to waste a lot of time doing that. And, you know, they were sort of encouraged by the Trump administration, which wasn't a big fan of the peace process. Biden, again, our new president in the U.S., was part of the Obama team that was in place when this peace treaty here in Colombia was being negotiated. Biden's come in. His Secretary of State has already had a talk with Colombia's foreign minister saying, hey, carrying out the peace process is our number one agenda for Colombia right now, which is a pretty big deal because it's usually drugs and thugs that top the list of U.S. priorities in Colombia. So it looks like the State Department, the Biden administration really wants to see this peace treaty succeed. Again, we're getting towards the tail end of the Duque administration, and so it's a little bit hard to know whether that's going to make much difference here in the short term. But it really is a different frame of mind coming out of Washington, and that's really woken people up here in Colombia about the importance of the peace treaty. Biden's declarations and the Secretary of State's declarations about the importance of the peace process, that's really made headline news here in Colombia. And so there may be renewed efforts to, you know, do some of this rural development that really needs to take place because, you know, as we pointed out in this latest edition of America's Quarterly, a lot of these problems out in the rural areas are just providing openings for these drug gangs to wreak havoc.
Is there a mismatch between how much the international community cares about the peace process in Colombia and how much Colombians care about it?
I think it'd be unfair to say that because, you know, the Colombians are the ones who live here. And especially when you go out to rural areas, Brian, especially areas that the FARC guerrillas, you know, they used to be the lords of the county, and they used to run everything, and they used to bully people and kill people and run drugs. A lot of people in these areas are, you know, their lives have been changed by the peace process, and it's extremely important to them. It's hard to come across anybody, again, who says, you know, I think I want to go backwards in time to when the FARC ran the show. But again, it's in urban areas where public opinion is sort of formed and, you know, where a lot of the news is centered. There's a lot of people who haven't really felt the effects of the peace process because they never really felt the effects of the war. I think it's out in the rural areas where you really see more people saying this has changed our lives. But here in the city in Bogota, you know, you won't find so many people saying that kind of thing. And it's kind of too bad because you really do need a national perspective on something like this.
So much of the attention, as you pointed out, is being focused on the countryside. But one thing that we're seeing in urban areas as well is this phenomenon of, you know, gangs, organized crime groups. And we're talking about small ones and big ones, including the ELN, using the economic damage from the pandemic as an opportunity to increase recruitment. And, you know, it's fertile territory right now. This was the subject of this big piece that you wrote for us in the New America's Quarterly called Schools Out. The gangs are thrilled. What can you tell us about where you reported and what you found, and how important do you think it really is?
I flew down to the southwestern Colombian town of Tumaco, and this area is just sort of drug trafficking central. It's sort of a one-shop stopping place. You've got thousands of acres of coke out in the countryside. You've got drug gangs fighting for control, and you've got launching points for submarines and drug boats heading to, you know, bringing cocaine north. And it's also a very impoverished area. So you get out into the rural areas, there's not much in terms of internet connection or kids having access to computers or cell phones or anything that they can take classes on. So basically, there is no such thing as online learning in Tumaco and in a lot of other rural areas around Colombia. And so if you don't have online learning, these kids are pretty much just going home and hanging out and loitering in the street or whatever. And their parents are under economic duress because of the pandemic and the lockdowns. So that just makes these sort of restless kids with nothing much to do that much more susceptible to the offers that these drug gangs have. And it's been easier for them to recruit them into their ranks. And so it's really a tragic thing to see because, you know, these are kids, some of them are as young as, you know, 14 years old, 15 years old, you know, the age of my kids. And, you know, they're learning how to use weapons. And, you know, if the pandemic continues and kids remain out of school, you know, I don't know if we're looking at a completely lost generation here, but there's going to be a lot of kids who get lost to this sort of recruiting that happens because they're not able to go to schools, which, as we point out in the story, really do serve as safe places for kids.
These are just, you know, structural problems that I think are going to take years to sort out. And one data point that was present in your story was that 97% of Latin American kids were not physically in schools at the end of 2020. And man, I mean, if there was one data point, one thing that I could just go to a top of a mountain and shout about right now, it would be that, because the damage that that's going to cause for years to come is, it's economic, it's social, it will have an impact on violence potentially, as you're talking about. And it's an area where, you know, no other region in the world has a percentage that high.
The situation with education, I mean, it sort of seems like we're going to go back 10 years after making a lot of very hard-won progress.
Well, and two other stats. I mean, some researchers believe that the percentage of Latin American students who complete high school may fall from 61% to 46% because of the pandemic. And youth unemployment for 2020 reached almost 30%. So those are tough problems. And look, I mean, the whole world is facing challenges right now, but this really is one where it's worse in Latin America than it is in almost any other region. Shifting gears a bit, let's talk about politics, because, of course, when you have problems like this, the instinct, correctly, is to look to our leaders and the people who govern us for at least some of the solutions. How are Colombians feeling about their president, Iván Duque?
Well, as you mentioned, he's got kind of middling popularity ratings in the 30s. He was actually in pretty deep trouble when all the protests broke out in late 2019. He was really seen as floundering. And in some ways, the COVID pandemic kind of helped right the ship of state, because it gave President Iván Duque, who's a young guy, he's in his 40s, and he was, you know, widely seen as sort of a bit young for the job and too much under the influence of former President Álvaro Uribe, who's a right-wing conservative icon and hero to many Colombians. And so he wasn't really seen as his own man, and a lot of people sort of accused Uribe and some of the other more radicals in the governing ruling party as sort of pulling the strings behind Duque. I think that's somewhat of a caricature, but in any case, that was the popular perception. COVID came along and it gave his administration, it gave his presidency some focus. He came on and was doing nightly TV addresses that were at first quite popular. And he took the virus a lot more seriously. I tell a lot of people I felt a lot more comfortable and happy being here in Colombia during the pandemic than being in the U.S., where the Trump administration just sort of blew off all the science and, you know, and it was such a ragtag response. I felt a lot safer here. And part of that was due to President Duque and also Bogota Mayor Claudia López. They both took it very seriously. And so I think that helped Duque quite a bit. His ratings went back up. But now that sort of bump that he actually got from COVID, which, you know, might seem kind of counterintuitive because it's hurting some other leaders around the world, but that's starting to wear off now. And right now, a lot of Colombians are real worried about the vaccination process because Colombia has not started it yet. Vaccines haven't even arrived here yet. They're supposed to arrive here towards the end of this month. But, you know, I think a lot of what people might remember about Duque is how, you know, how he handles COVID-19 and whether this vaccination process goes off okay and Colombians get their vaccinations and they're able to get this pandemic under control.
I've known Iván Duque for a long time, since before he became president. And I mean, it makes sense to me why his popularity saw a bump through this whole process, because it gave him an opportunity to be competent and decent and to embrace science, which, as you point out, not every leader in the Americas did. But at the same time, you know, 35%, 36% popularity is not that much. And you get the feeling that people have been looking ahead to the next election in 2022 since virtually the moment he became president. I mean, what do you make of this idea that there's kind of a, not a power vacuum necessarily, but an absence of sufficient leadership at the top?
Well, part of it is lame duck syndrome. Colombia got rid of presidential re-election several years ago. So Duque is a one-term president. There's nothing he can really do about that. And so I think there's a natural tendency when the next election is looming for people to look ahead and kind of dismiss the guy who's shown up in the presidential palace every day. You know, another thing is people in Duque's own party, the Centro Democrático, is sort of divided between moderates like Duque and kind of hardline radicals who don't really like Duque that much and don't support him that much and are always, you know, talking behind his back about, you know, he's a weak president. So he doesn't really have the whole party behind him. So that's another problem that Duque's had. And also the ruling party is supposed to be the National Security Party. And, you know, they sort of came back into power in 2018, promising law and order and security. And as we've just got done discussing, that hasn't worked out so well. And so now, because of that, a lot of people are looking on to the 2022 election. Again, Duque can't run, so there's a scramble for status within the ruling party, and also you know, within the opposition, to see who's gonna be able to run. You know, another thing that just happened is Colombia's defense minister Carlos Holmes Trujillo passed away just last week from COVID-19, and he was seen as one of the possible front runners for the, you know, for the ruling party nomination. So there's some big question marks about, you know, who's going to be on the ballot next year.
I want to talk about that tragic death of Holmes here in a second, but before we do, just to pause briefly for 2022 and talk about the election. We look a lot at presidential elections in America's Quarterly, and I always ask myself, is it too early to be talking about this? But actually, I think in the Colombian context, you can make a case that it's time, right? In part because people there on the ground are already talking about it. And it looks like you've got, you know, this candidate on the left with Gustavo Petro, who came reasonably close to getting elected back in 2018. You've got kind of a center-left figure in Sergio Fajardo, the former governor of Antioquia, who is, you know, leading some polls right now, though, but in a very fragmented field. What do you make of this election? How many other candidates are there really room for? And I mean, is there anybody who qualifies as an early favorite?
I think within the ruling party, which is the Centro Democrático or Democratic Center Party, Iván Duque's party, it's the party founded by Álvaro Uribe, the former president. One person to keep our eyes on is Vice President Marta Lucía Ramírez. She has been defense minister. She's held a lot of government positions. So I think she's going to be running again, but it's unclear whether she's going to try to run as some kind of an independent or stay within the Centro Democrático party. There's going to be several other people within that party. I think Paloma Valencia, who's a pretty radical, hard-right senator, is going to probably try to run. Maybe some other figures, such as former Barranquilla mayor Alejandro Char, might run and might try to get the Centro Democrático nomination. He was a very popular mayor of Barranquilla and was also governor of Atlántico State up in northern Colombia. I think within the other parties, there's Germán Vargas Lleras, who is sort of a center-right guy. He was the vice president for Juan Manuel Santos, the former president who won the Nobel Peace Prize for signing the peace treaty. I think he's a name that's out there. And Gustavo Petro, as you mentioned, is going to run. I think, though, Brian, what a lot of people think right now is we could see kind of a replay of the 2018 election in which the electorate gets rather polarized, in which there's a whole lot of candidates in a first round. And the two sort of extremes on the left and the right, emerge into a second round and, you know, maybe we'll get another sort of conservative government again. That's kind of what a number of people I've talked to are sort of thinking very, very, very early on could happen, just because the center here in Colombia hasn't really managed to rally behind a single candidate. That was their big problem in 2018. They probably could have won the election had they done that, but they just didn't manage to get their act together. Everybody wanted to be president and nobody came together. So there were just too many candidates and that divided the vote for the center.
John, you mentioned the recent passing of Colombia's defense minister, Carlos Holmes Trujillo, because of COVID. You know, one thing I remember, and many other people do, Holmes for was his advocacy for Venezuelan migrants in Colombia. Currently, there are more than 1.7 million Venezuelans in Colombia. President Duque recently announced that his government could not afford to offer vaccines to unregistered migrants. I mean, given that declaration, as well as the recent passing of, you know, Holmes, do you think that we're seeing a shift in this, you know, what has been a very generous response by the Colombian state, the Colombian people to Venezuelan migrants? What do we know about the new defense minister? And I guess more important, what do we expect in terms of the treatment of these vulnerable folks?
Yeah, you know, Brian, I think Duque's statement was really unfortunate because, as you just got done saying, he's a guy who believes in science, and the science is that the more people you you vaccinate, the safer you're going to be. And it doesn't make any sense to refuse to vaccinate people just because they don't have the proper documents to come into Colombia when the border's closed and they're fleeing from a brutal dictatorship in Venezuela. I thought that was a really poor decision of Duque. I think he really ought to reverse course on that. But I think that's another case where he was probably under pressure from, you know, maybe hardliners in his party and a lot of just Colombians in general, because Venezuelan migration here overall isn't very popular. There's been a few high-profile cases of crimes committed by Venezuelan migrants. You know, you can understand this sentiment when you're a country that's really getting inundated with Venezuelan migrants. But at the same time, you know, Colombia has, for the most part, had an open door policy compared to a lot of other countries in Latin America. But again, sentiments are starting to shift. I was just up on the in the border area doing a story about rising xenophobia along the border. I was in this little town called Pamplona near the border, for example, and residents were really angry that so many Venezuelans were coming through their town. This is the town where Venezuelan migrants trying to get to Bogota and Ecuador and other places, they have to come through the town. So the town's always seeing these Venezuelan migrants come through. Shelters have been closed here to prevent COVID-19. So that forces these Venezuelans to sleep out on the streets. And a lot of people were pouring motor oil on the sidewalks and driveways in front of their homes because they didn't want Venezuelans sleeping there. So that's kind of the kind of thing you're starting to see. But, you know, Brian, at the same time, it's nice to see overall, again, overall, over the past 4 or 5 years, an open door policy in Colombia. And for the most part, a pretty big heart under the circumstances of Colombians. And again, it's a complex thing. It's not just black and white. It's not all welcome. It's not all rejection. It's a mix of things. But I think overall, Colombia's handled it pretty well.
So, John, ultimately, where do you think that leaves us? Should we be optimistic or pessimistic about Colombia?
I think, again, we're just in so much new territory here right now. With COVID-19, with the economic lockdowns, with, you know, possible new strains of the virus coming, with the vaccination program not having started here yet, and with an election coming up. And also all this began just after all the unrest from the 2019 protests. So, you know, there was a lot of kind of unrest and uncertainty already, even before COVID-19 came. And so it's just a big combination of factors that lead people to be, you know, rather worried right now, kind of wondering what's going to happen. There's been kind of a lack of very strong leadership at the top telling us where to go. But again, overall, I think Colombia is doing fairly well in the midst of heck of a lot of challenges.
John, thanks so much for joining us on the AQ podcast.
Thanks a lot, Brian. It's been nice to be here.
Thank you for listening to the America's Quarterly podcast. You can read more at americasquarterly.org. Finally, if you enjoyed the episode, please leave us a review, give us a rating, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. The America's Quarterly podcast is produced by Brendan O'Boyle and Leonie Rawls. America's Quarterly is an independent, not-for-profit publication of America's Society and the Council of the Americas.